All right, so the organizers asked me to talk about warps and wiggles and how that will tell us about the history of the Milky Way assembly and evolution. And this has been a problem that has actually interested me for a long period of time. One of the things I've learned by trying to study how galaxies evolve after formation is that all of the asymmetries that you actually see in galaxies are telling you that the galaxy is evolving. And so, in particular, one of the fascinating things about doing galactic dynamics rather than planetary dynamics or some other kind of dynamics is that you have a really very few number of actual dynamical times in which to do your work. And what that means is that the transients from the actual events that occur during assembly, during accretion, actually matter. And so the hope is that you can use what you see now in terms of asymmetries to tell you where the Milky Way came from in terms of its evolution and where it's going. And so in particular, I think in this audience, we've spent a lot of time talking about what happens with substructure. There's the satellites we see, there's the ones that we don't. In addition, we touched on a little bit yesterday that, of course, gas is coming in various ways, and that people have talked about, for example, cold mode streams, and of course, there's gas settling onto the disk, and there's lots of ways of actually disturbing the galaxy. Now, the reason that warps are interesting is that there's this stuff out there that we all seem to believe in, dark matter, and it's hard to diagnose. And so by looking at the regime where you go from a baryonic-dominated disk to a dark matter-dominated disk is certainly going to tell you something about what's really happening with the dark matter in our galaxy. It'll turn out to depend very sensitively. This response in this outer part of the disk will depend very sensitively on the properties of the dark matter halo, and there's other alternatives that one might consider, and they will behave differently. So in principle, not only do we learn about the dark matter, but potentially any changes in physics that are going on. So this is really kind of a walkthrough of bits and pieces of how one might learn things from warps and other kinds of distortions. And I'll discuss a few kinds of distortions throughout. So the basic, oh yes, and of course a key point is that this is very difficult to see. However, we do have the neutral gas layer, which Leo so well described in the previous talk. And this neutral gas layer is extremely sensitive to any of these distortions. And so it's a good place to look. So that's essentially what the direction I'm pushing in. Okay, so I've already told you about my motivation for looking at this. I'm going to begin with a short walkthrough of the different avenues that tell us that there's interesting things happening in the outer parts of the galaxy. Turns out there's a couple interesting things happening in the inner part of the galaxy as well, and these are all connected to various kinds of asymmetries. Then as an example, I will talk about how warps work, really. And I'm going to emphasize making warps by satellite encounters or halo encounters, or whatever kind of encounters that you want. I do want to point out there's a lot of other ways of making warps, and I'll come to that. And this is just an example, and I think a nice example of how these dynamics work. Finally, at the end, I want to talk about explicit gas response, and for those who keep it track, this is actually work that I started to really look at when I was here for the last few weeks. And I'll have a fairly extensive discussion at the end of where I think this is going. Okay, so I'm going to go quickly through these. By this point, I think everything that I have in these data slides has been mentioned by Leo or alluded to by Rosie, and there's maybe one thing that we haven't talked about yet. So this is the warp asymmetric, higher in quadrants 1 and 2 than in quadrants 3 and 4. This is the solar circle. We've talked all about this, so I can skip that. This is the primary motivation. When I first saw this from the work by Levine et al., I said, oh boy, I think I know how we can do this. Even more interesting, I thought, was this. In particular, as Joss was pointing out, I think this is not the standard quasi-static spiral structure theory. It will not work at surface densities at densities this low. So, you know, being interested in how you get structure and halo, I immediately said, oh boy, it's the halo that's causing spiral structure, and I'll come back to that. Since one wants to try and verify everything, one of the things that people started to look at in our outer galaxy is not only the overall location of the diffuse H1, but clouds. And this is an interesting paper by Strasser et al. And what they were interested in was looking at the H1 clouds in absorption against distant sources, showing that, in fact, there were little clumps way out in the galaxy. And so this is one of the distant arms. This is at 23 kiloparsecs, or I think 22 kiloparsecs. And they have found, this is what's shown down here, a bunch of clouds that have enough column density that they can see the thing in absorption. It's saying it's not diffuse, but actually clumps. The question is, what's making these clumps? Coming to that. So I think those are all things that one wants to try and explain. And these are the lovely H-alpha pictures from Annette Ferguson that Rosie Wise was just talking about. I have three of these, and the point is this is the optical radius of the galaxy, and you can see this sort of string of H1 regions that are going way out into the outer galaxy. There's another one. Another one. Okay, so there's clearly things that are going on. And, you know, this would not happen, right? This is the optical radius. This would not happen in your standard quiescent picture of spiral structure. Okay, finally, let's moving on to the inner galaxy. This is some old work by Blitz, Binney, a bunch of different people, looking at the molecular gas at the center of the galaxy. And one of the interesting things, of course, is that here is L equals zero, and you notice that there's a lovely parallelogram suggesting a quadrupole potential, but it's offset. And this offset is about 100 parsecs. So this is a non-trivial offset. So there's things going, there's offsets in the outer galaxy, offsets in the inner galaxy, and I think it's up to us to understand these. You might argue, okay, they're little features, but they're telling you something about what happened in the past, or potentially what's happening in the present to make these distortions, and that it's worth getting to the bottom of. So I have a couple of answers to these. My case study, as I mentioned, was to look at the warp, and so let me go through this really quickly. As I mentioned earlier, there's lots of different ways of making a warp. So here's four of the ways that people have looked at in the past. You can just say, okay, there's some very strong modes, and once they get excited by whatever mechanism, they just sit there, and they're warped forever, quote unquote. Of course, it could be a response to a triaxial halo. It could be a response to cold stream accretion. All of these have been, you know, recently discussed. And, you know, there's the one that I'm going to look at today, which is the response to satellites and bombardment. Now, I want to point out that there's no reason it can't be all of these. Well, maybe not that one. But there's no reason why it can't be all three of them. The thing I like about this one is that we know satellites are there. If you believe in the land of CDM, we know that the disk is being bombarded by things. So at the very least, these responses should be present in our galaxy. That doesn't mean these other things can't be going on. So I'm going to talk about this one in this talk, but I want to point out some dynamics here, because there's been a lot of disinformation or misunderstanding of how this thing actually works. And one of the things that it's important to understand is that when you see an asymmetric structure in a galaxy, it depends somewhat on the perturber, but it depends more on the galaxy itself. And so the way I like to say this is, if you take a bell and you hit it with a big hammer, it rings. And if the hammer is made of steel, you get a lot of high frequency things, but if you wait long enough, right, you hear the few lowest order modes of the bell. And similarly with a galaxy, galaxy dynamics a little bit more complicated than that of a bell, but the same thing basically happens. So, said, I think, more eruditely, that any of these large-scale features, for example, that Leo, like the ones that Leo were talking about, are collective effects. Large-scale feature has to be a collective effect. I don't see any other way of doing it, unless it's just a pure kinematic response. Possible, I suppose. You're talking about dark matter. A collective response has both the standard kinds of normal modes, but that it also has a continuous spectrum, sort of like wave packets, and both things go on at the same time. Which ones dominate depends on the kind of disturbance you actually impose on the system. So the model I like to think of is if we think of a purely orbiting satellite like the LMC, you're going to pretty preferentially excite the halo in some discrete places in frequency space. And this is just a pictorial representation. It really doesn't describe a particular galaxy. Of course, orbits are decaying and things are changing, and that will spread these out, but they'll still be at well-defined places. On the other hand, if you were to do a one-shot perturbation, like a passing galaxy or something like that, then you get a spectrum of frequencies that's very broad. Both of them will excite structure in the disk. The ones that are discrete frequencies, if they tend to line up with modes, you'll get a big excitation of those modes, and that's what you'll see. On the other hand, if you hit it with a lot of different frequencies, you'll get power in those modes, but you'll also get everything else in between, which will quickly damp out. Okay, so that's the basic difference. So in order to understand these things, we need to think about the natural structure of the halo. That's when you see asymmetric features, it's going to tell you about the galaxy. And that's why how I started out. We're learning more about the galaxy at some level by looking at the features than actually the perturbers. And this is true for any perturbation you want to make to a galaxy. Okay, so let me look back to the bending modes. This is a picture of the M equals 1 bending modes for a disk, which is embedded in a halo. And the simplest mode is basically a tipping mode. If you imagine there was no halo, one mode would just be to take the disk and tip it. When you put it in a halo, this tipping mode, there's zero halo mass. This tipping mode turns into sort of a bent thing. And of course, really what you should imagine is there's one coming down here as well, because M equals 1 mode, and you can see you get the nice integral sign. So the tipping mode turns into the integral sign, and that's why I think that these things are so ubiquitous everywhere. It's the lowest order mode. Excuse me? I don't like dead halos. No, it's live. Nothing works without a live halo. The whole thing is a live halo, right? What I'm saying is that what you're seeing is the halo response. Without the halo being quote unquote live, nothing happened. This is a round halo, yeah. For this particular mode, right? Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to talk a little bit in the remaining 10 or 15 minutes about a calculation that shows what happens when the Magellanic clouds excite the halo with these modes. We then look at how these modes in the halo excited by the clouds distort the disk. And the interesting thing about this is that unlike a pure tidal effect, the non-local influence of the clouds on the dark matter particles actually allow, if you like, the amplitude to get very close to the inner disk. And in particular, the dominant amplitude will be basically a 2-to-1 resonance. And that'll bring it halfway between, for example, the clouds and the center of the Milky Way, where the outer disk actually lives, and it can give a very large effect, much larger than what you would imagine if you just did a simple tidal calculation. Now, this kind of work is a struggle for simulations because it involves doing things on multiple time scales and multiple length scales, and so what I'm describing here is perturbation theory. We have done some simulations, and other people have done simulations, and where we can compare them, they seem to agree. This is linear theory, though, and so it'll break down when the amplitudes get very large. And so this is just a combination of things I've worked on for a while and trying to understand how halos respond combined with the old 100 2D bending mode calculations And let me just show you the results. So this is actually two slides, next to each other, showing the full warp excitation. And this one shows some particular mode of the warp excitation in and of itself. So, for example, this is modes M equals 0, 1, 2, 3, and 4, and this is just the mode 0. What you're seeing here is a bound LMC orbit. That's the LMC. Red is paracenter, blue is apocenter. And I have a few of these. So here's the total one for... this is basically the current position of the LMC and from our view outside the galaxy. In this coordinate system, X is from the Sun towards the galactic center, Y is the direction of solar rotation, and Z is north. So let me just show this one. So what you're actually going to see, click. I'm just going to do it with this silly mouse. What you're going to see is the time evolution of this. And you'll notice a couple of things. In the M equals 1, there's a modulation of the M equals 1 depending on how close you are to apocenter and paracenter. And, of course, it peaks up during paracenter. And you'll notice that all on the... I'll do it one more time. On the left-hand side, you can see that there's lots of asymmetries. And in fact, a detailed paper that Leo and I wrote, the asymmetries in nodal orientations of M equals 0, 1, and 2 actually line up fairly, or you can make them line up fairly well with the data. Now, that in itself is not such a big deal. A slight change in the halo or the disk profile or the orientation of the orbits can easily change all of these phases around. And so it isn't that big a deal to actually find one that actually matches. I think matching is not all that interesting. What is interesting, though, is that you can straightforwardly make these kinds of excitations. And yeah, so the point is, that I'm trying to make, is that you need to understand the mechanisms. But finding a fit has lots of different components. It depends on the orbit, it depends on what you think the dark halo is doing, etc., etc. So, I don't think you're learning anything from fit. So I'm trying to emphasize that this mechanism must exist.
You have this orbit, which is going to be measured pretty well now, and it's going to be measured extremely well in 2 years. And then, so if you have these other things, then you say, well, okay, this is really what the dark halo effect is. And then,
I think there's still a lot of degeneracy in the parameters. I think eventually you will be able to either test the hypothesis that this is an important thing going on and therefore test dark matter theory, etc., etc. That will happen. I think at this point you're not there yet. I'm coming to that. Yeah. Well, it actually is. I just haven't shown it. I'm going to show you that in a second. Oh man. What is going on here? There we go. I know, you know, I've never had this kind of problem before. What's going on? Yeah. Look, all these different mouses are confusing it. All right.
I don't know what's happening.
Okay, anyway, what I want to show you now is what's going on with the halo wake. And there's a number of different components that, you know, of course, it's hard to render in one of these simulations, as Joss is pointing out. So this is showing what's going on in Halo while all this is happening. So here you have an M equals zero vertical force distortion. At the same time, you have an M equals one vertical force distortion. Here's an M equals two vertical force distortion, and finally an M equals three vertical force distortion. You'll notice that a couple of interesting things. They extend from very far out in the halo to very far in the disk. And so this is actually the key point that makes the warp. The other thing that you can look at is what's happening, as Joss pointed out, in the disk plane, and I didn't show that here, because this isn't a simulation. This is my feeble attempt at three-dimensional rendering. So let me just show you what happens with a satellite in an NFW halo, and you'll notice that there's a very large, so this is, I'm describing here, this is the M equals one potential distortion. I've split this and mapped it, so this is in fact the negative logarithmically scaled warp, and this is the positive logarithmically scaled halo potential. This is the same for the quadrupole, and you'll notice that they're very strong, and the first thing that will happen is you'll take the inner part of the Milky Way and you'll move it one direction or the other. And that amplitude is the same order of magnitude necessary to account for the 100 parsec slosh in the inner Milky Way. So you will get sloshing, absolutely, and it's a natural consequence of all of this stuff. Okay, back, so first passage. So as you know, there's been a discussion that perhaps with the latest proper motion measurements that the LMC may not be orbiting but on first approach. And there was a comment in the paper by, a very, very lovely paper actually by Vesla et al, that described this work with this comment, highly unlikely the LMC excites a warp. And of course my response is it's highly unlikely that it's highly unlikely the LMC excites a warp. And so for this talk I set about trying to do this, and this is the plot from the Vesla et al. Paper showing that given the current proper motion and an appropriate NFW profile that more or less matches the rotation curve with the disk, what the LMC trajectories should have been and in the past. And so this is their best estimate. This is 1 and 2 sigma. So I'm going to show you, in fact, a 1 and 2 sigma sample from these trajectories. Now, an interesting thing here is, in this case, what happens is that you get a single passage, and the orbit is so large that I actually, in terms of if you want to look at this on the screen, that I actually focused in on the disk. This is their best fit proper motion orbit, and this is 1 sigma from that. And you'll notice, and this is actually, this is where the LMC is. It's under here. This is the current position of the LMC near paracenter. And this shows the two orbits, and you can see that they're somewhat different. As I mentioned earlier, and as an example of what I said earlier, a slight change in that orbit gives you a very different orientation for the warp, but still a significant warp nonetheless. I didn't mention earlier that these warps, I think I did mention maybe, that they match the Levine et al. Amplitudes fairly well. In this case, you can get amplitudes that are much larger than the Levine et al. Also, or smaller by very slight changes in the proper motion, which, you know, is a bit discouraging in some sense, but maybe encouraging in other senses. So let me just show you to give you a feeling for what it looks like. In this case, we're starting at 3 gigayears from paracenter, going towards 3 gigayears towards paracenter. In this case, we're dominated by the continuous wave packet-like excitation. And you see a very large excitation when the LMC passes, then it damps up quickly, relatively quickly, with 3 gigayears. Okay, so that works as well. I think I agree with Andy at some level. You ought to be able to get this straightened out. And if you really thought you understood the dark matter halo really well, and I look very hard at these underlying diagnostics, potentially one has leverage on whether or not that's a consistent orbit or not. I haven't looked at that in detail. In fact, I did this last week. So. Oh, this business. I guess I'm not showing any more movies. I don't know why this happens every time I show a movie. so strange. No one's going to believe me, and I've done this hundreds of times. Never had a problem.
All right. So, moving on. I've already said this. Okay. Moving on, as I started to think through this problem, I wanted to understand what the gas really, how the gas really responds in one of these. In fact, what I've been telling you now has, in fact, not been pure gas, but it's been a collision with this. And so I set out to try and think about what the gas really does. Now, the amplitude of the distortions in the halos basically scales as the mass ratio. It's fairly straightforward to work out just from looking at the rate at which the node line of nodes precess that the pattern speed is supersonic. So throughout the outer galaxy, you'd expect shocks in the disk. As the gas shocks, angular momentum is removed, so you'd expect gas inflow. And I think most of you know that if there's that we need to have account for the gas inflow that's making the stars at you know, rate of one solar mass per year. So the interesting thing is whether or not you can actually do this, and moreover, whether or not all of the noise from all of the substructure in the halo can in fact produce enough sort of transient outer halo asymmetry to keep the shocks going and to give you a continuous flux of inward going gas. So I'm trying to work this out. This is actually a difficult calculation. That led me to the next suggestion, trying to put all of these little bits together, that in fact perhaps noise, for lack of a better word, from accretion is actually the major driver of all disk structure. Bars, spiral arms, and not all of this lovely self-excitation from within the disk. I actually think it's very likely. Of course, it's yet to be worked out. Now, it turns out, and I have one more minute to talk about this. It turns out that for other reasons, I got very interested in the breakdown of hydrodynamics and astrophysical regimes. And I wrote this direct simulation Monte Carlo code. The advantage of a direct simulation Monte Carlo code is that it's 100% shock. There's no Levi-Courant condition. There's a lot of nice features of it. The disadvantage of it is it's god-awfully slow. So, you know, whatever. I'm patient. So I thought I would try this. And, of course, this was the first attempt at trying to put this in a real galaxy. I'd done all kinds of shock tube calculations and Kelvin Helmholtz tests, so those were all fine. Okay, that's good. And let me just show you what happens. This is what happens. You get I threw in a perturber, and the first thing that happens, you get a bar forming. And you can see all kinds of shocks occurring in the disk. And this is the same simulation, not simulation. This simulation is the same initial galaxy as the initial setup as the previous LMC simulation. So I used the base velocity that came from the Bessel et al. Paper, and I threw it at the galaxy in exactly the same way that I showed you for the warp. What I then did is I suppressed the m equals 2, and the bar didn't form. So clearly there's some triggering going on here, and this happens very early on. So it is very sensitive. The other thing I wanted to point out is the structure in the disk. You see there's little shocklets and shear structure everywhere throughout the disk. And this is very similar, in fact, to the kind of structure that you actually observe in the H1 and distant galaxies. And I should point out, there's no self-gravity in the disk, there's no magnetic fields. All there is this gas and standard cooling. Okay, let me move on to my conclusions. This is just showing, in fact, that exactly what you expect happens. The inner gas moves in, the outer gas moves out. Okay, so let me go to the implications. I think I'm over time now. In principle, you can see all these things in in-body simulations. I don't want to go into this in too much detail, except to show that where these things have been done in simulations, and I've compared them with my theory, we agree. So in fact, Tusachia did a calculation which showed that the amplitudes of the warp that I predicted in My old 1998 paper on this subject actually were found in simulations. Balin Steinmetz looked at the Sag dwarf excitation, and I have that if someone wants to see it, but I agree with the amplitude of the excitation they got for the Sag dwarf. So I'm pretty sure that the theory more or less is reproducing the basic features. Again, you know, I'm not a fan of Occam's razor. I believe that all of these things are probably going on simultaneously, and I pushed on this particular explanation because, you know, it's a straightforward one to do, and we know it has to be there, but all these other things could be going on at the same time. Forget about that. So let me conclude with this slide. So what do I think is interesting, and where do I think we should go with this? So I haven't mentioned, but maybe it's obvious, that the coherent warping is always going to be dominated by the largest substructure in the parent halo. In fact, if you look at if you add the Sag dwarf wake to the OMC wake, you see the OMC wake. The Sag dwarf is down, the amplitude of the wake is down by about a factor of 100. More interestingly, and this is a hard calculation, is that the outer disk may be excited by the cumulative subhalo population in addition to the single one. And this is a hard calculation because if you think about lots of different perturbations all going on at the subhalo at the same time, you think about a little blob of gas, dark or star somewhere, at some point during the calculation, you'll see one particular subhalo affecting you, and then another time you see another particular subhalo affecting you, and so forth and so on. And they really all add up, but one will dominate. And so what matters is the temporal cross correlation of the time coherence, and that has to, in fact, give you the noise spectrum that you add in. And you know, these calculations are doable, but they're hard. Now, people think that this is really worth pursuing. I'm willing to sort of gird my loins and go into this again. It makes my hair gray, as you can tell. Nonetheless, I mean, I think I understand and believe enough of the basic underlying dynamics here to think that, as Leo pointed out, that an H1 structure survey and external galaxies will really allow us to get to the bottom of how these various things are interacting and what, in fact, we should look for in our own galaxy. I think making models like this is very difficult, and we really need to get inspired by looking and motivation from looking at external galaxies. Finally, I'll just leave you with these three things. Does halo structure cause spiral lines? I threw it out. I think it's a likely consequence of what I talked about, but obviously a lot more work needs to be done to understand how these things go. Okay, I'm done.
What happens if you accrete a galaxy in the plane of the disk and get it closer to the Milky Way center compared to the OMC? Basically, if you accrete Canis Major.
Well, that's a complicated question. So, but I haven't looked at that. Obviously, if it's in the plane of the disk, you're not going to get warping. What you'll see in the disk plane, of course, will be a cascade of non-axisymmetric structure at m equals 1, which sloshes the disk, at m equals 2, which triggers bar-like things. So see 3 and 4 arm structure as well. Whether or not you end up with a... I'm not sure exactly what question you're getting at. You asked about the warp? Obviously, there'll be no warp. There'll be significant distortions, though, in the in-plane, to the in-plane asymmetry. It'll depend on the concentration of the halo whether or not it disrupts before it reaches, you know, the inner disk or not. So there's a lot of ifs in all of that.
So naively, it seems like the way to do this is to go and observe, you know, 100 edge-on warp disks out there and look for satellites and, you know, just test observationally how the warps and the satellites match up. Is looking at Virgo going to sort of move towards that, or is that feasible observationally to get that many disks?
Well, the problem with looking at Virgo is lots of other things are going on. And as you know, if you look in the outskirts of Virgo, there's all kinds of ram pressure stripping going on in the cluster medium. In fact, that's partly what motivated looking at this direct simulation. The Monte Carlo calculation was to look at things like that. I think a better choice is to look at more isolated disks. And in fact, you know, people have done that, and there's some very nice surveys looking at each one stellar components, but it's harder to see warps, as you know, in a stellar component. I think this does motivate, though, a larger H1 edge-on isolated galaxy survey to try and get to the bottom of it. You know, one of the things that impressed me from 15 or almost 20 years ago was the work by Zeritsky and White, where they are trying to, in fact, do halo timing arguments based on satellites. But as a byproduct of that, they actually got a nice census of what the satellite frequency and mass distribution was in isolated galaxies. And in fact, it's fairly consistent with what we see in the Milky Way. The LMC is one sigma to the high side, but not off scale. And so most isolated galaxies have halos, I think, have satellites, I think, to do the job.
Martin, it wasn't obvious to me that there is like a smoking gun feature that one may aim for in order to understand whether there are these dark matter substructures that cold dark matter would predict. That's the impression I got from your talk, in the sense that almost every perturbation will cascade down to almost every scale at some point. Is that your view as well? Or is there something that if one sees it, it will be most likely produced by small clumps, bombarded the disk than, say, LMC-like perturbations?
Yeah, no, I mean, the large-scale warps have to be produced by large objects. And so that's, you can actually compute what that amplitude would be, and you can scale it. And so, and in fact, if you go down the halo mass function, which we think we understand from dark matter simulations such as yours, that you're totally dominated by the high step. And in fact, the largest one is doing most of the damage. Looking at the noise spectrum is a different issue, right? Because you can, in fact, take the whole orbital structure of all the dark matter halo and try and compute what's the projection of the incoherent noise on some of these. I think that's interesting. I haven't done that yet because it's hard work. And I've been waiting for sufficient motivation that if I do such a thing, we'd actually be able to get some observational tests of it. So I do think there should be a distinct feature that differentiates the incoherent noise from the large-scale warping. And I think my point I tried to get across was I think one way of doing it, in fact, might be to look at this neutral hydrogen morphology in external galaxies.
But even in the case where...
But I don't know what the smoking... I don't know what the distinct signature will be. I just suspect it'll be very different than, the coherent large-scale warp philosophy.
But in the last, last plot you showed it with your direct simulation code, it seemed they can get all sorts of, very small-scale features from just, one single major perturber. Is that, a discouraging factor in this? Or?
Well, I'm not discouraged. I just want to know how it is. Should I be discouraged?
So isn't the M31 NGC-205 system the next thing to look at after the Milky Way? So you can get five phase-based coordinates after a while. And
yeah. No, I think that would be very interesting. Yeah. Unfortunately, the M31 system is quite complex. But still, I think that would be a good thing to do. Yeah, it is. I think doing H1 is going to be kind of tricky for M31, just because of the foreground contamination from the Milky Way. I was hoping, in fact, that the Allen telescope would be a really good survey instrument for looking at some of these things, because in that case, or in the case of looking at large-scale structural asymmetries, you don't need the highest resolution. But what you would like is to really stack, or I shouldn't think it's like stack, but combine the statistics from lots of different detections. And so I kind of think that might be a little bit more promising in terms of trying to find the unique signature that you should look for in asymmetries in general. And you know, I think going following what Scott said, I guess I've learned that these things can be degenerate theoretically, and it really is worth saying, look, it's an important thing to get the H1 survey of structural asymmetries in a large fraction of galaxies. And let's do that and then learn from that where that might take us. Unique predictions are kind of hard in this game. That's all to answer Julio's question. Yeah, I'm a little discouraged by that, but on the other hand, this is the way it is.
So it wasn't quite clear to me. When you showed your direct simulation Monte Carlo calculation, you had the LMC orbit that you had in your perturbative calculation. Maybe just because it's face-on, but it doesn't look like there's a strong warp in that disk.
No, there isn't, but it hasn't even gotten to parity.
It hasn't gotten to parity. Yeah. So how far away is it?
Unfortunately, it was at about 120 kiloparsecs.
Okay, so it's a matter of time.
But I thought it was interesting that 120 kiloparsecs, you're already seeing a significant bar trigger. Unfortunately, these things take about a month.
Your suggestion that halo structure is responsible for everything, for spiral arms, warps, bars, and so forth, is really interesting and a wonderful application, I may say, of Occam's razor. I am still bothered by the point that I made in my talk, which is that there's this rich structure over many different scales within the disk, but the disk of the H1 layer in the disk of our galaxy is absolutely flat to within a tenth of a percent. You have a sort of simple argument as to why or how halo substructure might be able to produce all of this complex behavior in the plane of the disk without perturbing the disk out of the plane at all?
Well, yeah, I think the optical disk is perturbed. And if I say optical disk, I mean stellar disk, is perturbed out of the plane somewhat. I mean, any real being has a nice poster or a collaborator.
Not inside 10 kiloparsecs.
Not inside 10 kiloparsecs, that's right. So
that's where the spiral structure is.
Yeah,
that's where the bar is.
Yeah. But when you have significant confinement by the disk potential, in any asymmetry in the disk, the shocks of the gas actually give high enough densities to locally cool the gas and just sits in the midplane. Now, so the question is, can you get enough asymmetric bending from the halo to actually give you an inner disk perturbation? And I don't see those in the models either. And so what you do see is enough to give you M equals 1 sloshing, where you take the entire disk and sort of move it back and forth. Or even, in fact, take the inner, if you have a cuspy halo, there's enough to actually shift the inner disk relative to the outer optical disk. But you don't see much distortion in any of these things or bending inside the solar circle. So I think that's just because at that point you're being dominated by the potential of the disk. And the aspect ratio is thick enough that if you try to do that, it just damps out quickly.
So then just one other brief question. How far away do you think Sag J star is from the center of the galaxy?
Oh, I have no idea. I mean, I don't even think that the warp stuff the warp stuff will not give you an answer to that because the amplitude is down so much. So I just believe what the observers told me. I think what was the latest one? 18, 16, 14. Oh, kiloparsec, sorry. Yeah. Kiloparsec. I actually have no idea. Oh, I thought you said Sag. Oh, Sag A star. I have Sag dwarf in my brain. I have no idea. You have a better idea than me.
That was a good introduction for coffee break.
Yeah.
All right. Let's be back at 11.